China's role and influence in global affairs has been growing for the past couple of decades. But the global crisis caused by the coronavirus has damaged its international reputation. Will China be able to bounce back? In this episode, I discuss three sets of factors that may enable China to continue to exercise considerable global influence in a post-COVID era.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
When the coronavirus epidemic began attracting international attention in January 2020, the strength of the Chinese state was on full display. Beijing began implementing mass quarantines and disseminated evidence of its extraordinary logistical capacity to construct new hospitals within record time. Like everyone else, I was highly impressed with the capacity of the Chinese state to mobilize resources and to enforce mass quarantines successfully. There was little information and hence very little discussion then about the authorities possibly delaying the declaration of a crisis, which in turn may have resulted in the situation getting worse. Indeed, much of that initial global media attention, heavily influenced by official Chinese media reports and relatively successful social media campaigns, focused on the impressive set of measures that China was able to undertake. Many began to compare China's administrative power and capacity with that of other countries in the world. So, for example, there was concern over how African states with fragile and underfunded health systems would respond to a catastrophe of such magnitude. There was also concern that a country like India, despite its growing economic might, has in fact a weak health system, and that the Indian authorities would not be able to mount as effective a response as China did. So, in the initial months of the crisis in early 2020, the main narrative coming from China was very much, in my view, inward-looking, in that Beijing was projecting for its citizens, as well as to the world, that it could control the outbreak and that no other country would be able to perform better on this matter than what it was already doing. Gradually, however, the narrative began to shift to one where Beijing has pursued a much more aggressive public relations campaign. A part of this campaign, of course, is meant to address growing incidences of racism against Chinese citizens abroad, especially in the United States. Beijing also wants to counteract media reports that have highlighted how African residents of Guangzhou in China have been detained by the authorities during the COVID outbreak and how many have been forcibly evicted from their homes. But Beijing has also sent masks and gloves and other essential medical equipment to large parts of the world. This is of late been termed by some as mask diplomacy. In doing so, Chinese leaders and business tycoons such as Jack Ma, who have been involved in such relief efforts aimed at cultivating more international goodwill, have received considerable praise and gratitude from many countries. Indeed, Chinese diplomats have suddenly become far more vocal in print and social media sites than before. Branded in the West as wolf warrior diplomats, their aim has been to control the growing international backlash, especially from the United States, that has blamed China for intentionally spreading the virus. And even within China, many have expressed support for people such as the late Li Wenliang, the doctor who warned his colleagues and the government about the dangers of a new virus, only to be silenced by the authorities. Beijing is thus loudly defending its handling of the pandemic and is pushing back against anyone that questions its version of how the events have unfolded. Despite some initial predictions that the pandemic would weaken state legitimacy within China and more recent allegations of underreporting of the actual number of coronavirus-related deaths, both the Communist Party of China and its undisputed leader Xi Jinping appear to have weathered the storm, at least for the time being. And as Jessica Chen Weiss from Cornell University has recently argued, and I quote, coronavirus appears to have strengthened Xi's grasp on power, despite the shockwave that the outbreak initially sent through the system, end quote. She also rightly highlights the fact that, and I quote, the struggles of other countries have made it harder for liberals to argue democratization is the solution to China's ills, end quote. Lockdowns in China were gradually lifted and the economy has been restarted. But there are also now growing international demands to undertake an impartial investigation of the origins of the virus and the manner in which the Chinese leaders have managed the pandemic in the initial weeks of 2020. There are certainly worrying signs about Beijing's rapidly deteriorating relations with the United States. But it is not just the United States. It is also Beijing's deteriorating relations with Southeast Asian countries and also with India. And during the just concluded National People's Congress in May 2020, Beijing, for the first time since 2002, abandoned an annual GDP growth target for the current financial year. It has also informed the world of its intention of deploying more aggressive measures to combat protest movements in Hong Kong. Despite these developments, I believe China's role and influence will only increase in a post-COVID world. And here are three reasons why. Let us first discuss Beijing's support for multilateralism. Having achieved substantial success in promoting economic growth and poverty reduction in the first decade of the 21st century, China became more confident of carving out a more influential global role for itself and making the transition from being a rule taker to being a rule maker. China achieved considerable progress in achieving the Millennium Development Goals, or the MDGs, which were a set of 8 goals mainly related to development and poverty reduction. And then the country gradually began to feel more confident and more ready to play an unusually active role in the drafting of the 2030 Agenda on Sustainable Development, which was adopted by world leaders in September 2015. An important step was for China to gradually abandon the strategy of selective multilateralism that it had pursued for many decades. Beijing thus began to actively shape the policies of the BRICS group of countries. We're talking about Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. Beijing began to establish new multilateral institutions such as the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, or the AIIB, and the New Development Bank, and also began advocating the idea that all countries should enjoy equal rights to participation in international rulemaking. Beijing has also in recent years warmly embraced the United Nations and many multilateral agencies, as exemplified in numerous speeches by Chinese leaders. It has also realized in the wake of the global financial crisis that its economy has been for long over-dependent on the West, and that in many ways it needed to boost cooperation with the rest of the world. Thus, Beijing has portrayed its growing international engagement as part of its consistent commitment to globalization. As President Xi declared during a major international summit in Beijing in May 2017, and I quote, "In a world of growing interdependency and challenges, no country can tackle the challenges, also the world's problems, on its own," end quote. And some Chinese scholars have thus argued that those that are critical or even suspicious of China's intentions in trying to engage more actively with the world community are, I quote, "blinded by an outdated Cold War mindset," end quote. In this context, an interesting tactic for Beijing has been to embrace environmental concerns and support the international sustainable development agenda. Chinese leaders frequently talk about climate change and the need to promote sustainable development, not just within China, but also globally. And particularly appealing to many low-income countries is Beijing's strong support for the common but differentiated responsibility principle, according to which all countries embrace the same goals, but their relative burdens ought to reflect national contexts and individual development priorities. With the growing menace of air pollution and concerns over food safety within its own borders, the discourse within China is now increasingly focused on the desire for blue skies, for clean air, for clean water, and for safe food. And in addition to international recognition, it is particularly useful for Beijing to promote the virtues of sustainable development at a time when the general public in China is worried about an economic slowdown, or as some have termed it, stagflation. The point I'm trying to make here is that with the traditional powers such as the United States retreating from the world stage, Beijing has actively tried to fill the void. Indeed, in explaining its economic success and the crucial role it now plays in the global supply chain, Beijing has gone at great lengths to project itself as the poster child of globalization. Consider, for example, the politics of funding the World Health Organization, or the WHO. In April 2020, President Trump of the United States accused the WHO of mismanagement of the coronavirus pandemic and claimed that the WHO repeatedly parroted the Chinese government's claims that the coronavirus was not spreading between humans. Mr. Trump also complained that the WHO praised the Chinese government's response throughout January 2020. And in the last week of May, Mr. Trump declared that the United States would be terminating its relationship with the WHO, which would mean the UN agency risks losing almost $500 million in funding. While China bashing may be an effective strategy to win the upcoming elections in the US, this conflict, this disagreement between the United States and the WHO certainly also provides yet another example of the gradual withdrawal of the United States from the international arena. This also means that Beijing now has an opportunity to fill funding gaps and thereby assume even more global influence. A second set of issues relates to China's very ambitious Belt and Road Initiative, or the BRI. Now, a persistent complaint among many world leaders is the poor state of their roads, their ports, their bridges, and the lack of interest in the international community to fund infrastructure projects. China's solution to this problem is the ambitious Belt and Road Initiative, launched in 2013 and estimated to cost over $5 trillion. Beijing's long-term plan is to undertake a series of large investments in roads, bridges, gas pipelines, railways, ports, and power plants in over 70 countries. And these activities, according to the official BRI policy document, are a so-called positive endeavor to seek new models of international cooperation and global governance. After a slow start, the Belt and Road Initiative is now picking up steam. And thus far, BRI activities have been completed in several countries. For example, in Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Cambodia, Indonesia, Kazakhstan, Iran, North Korea, and even Hungary. And there are several other projects either underway or being negotiated in Bangladesh, Laos, Israel, Mongolia, Turkey, and the Ukraine. There are also numerous projects already underway or planned in Latin America and Europe. So what has been the reaction so far? Well, countries and organizations tend to interpret the Belt and Road Initiative in various terms. Some believe it is a form of national vision. Others would say it is Communist Party propaganda or a quest for world recognition of China's might. Still others would say these are investments in concrete projects to enhance world trade. And then there are others who would say, well, it is actually a major shift in international development policy and thereby offers a fantastic platform for global cooperation. The construction of a new military base with BRI funds in Djibouti, the first overseas base for the People's Liberation Army, has of course lent some credibility to claims by some that the real intention of China is to seek both economic as well as military dominance in world affairs. So one fear has been that the BRI is perhaps hollow and simply an attempt to project China as a reliable and strong superpower. But others point to also the fact that there are trouble spots in the regions between China and Europe and question the viability of implementing major infrastructure projects in these areas, which are politically highly unstable. India is particularly opposed to the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which has been an important part of the BRI. India believes this China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, like many of the other engagements the Chinese have with Pakistan, threatens India's sovereignty by bringing the Chinese presence even closer to its borders in the east and west. And in recent months, India and China have been involved in major border disputes. Most international organizations appear to view the BRI actually in positive terms. They believe the BRI can make a constructive contribution in promoting global development. So several leaders and organizations, including the United Nations, have often warmly embraced BRI. And several European countries, including Spain, the UK and France, have also expressed support in recent years. One country that has been very supportive of BRI, particularly since the onset of COVID, has been Italy. And there are voices in Italy that have highlighted the lackluster support that the country has received from the EU and the generally warm and generous support that the country has received in terms of medical equipment, etc., from China. Despite growing concerns about its true intentions and opposition from the United States, from Japan and India, China tends to claim that its BRI activities will promote new models of international cooperation and strengthen global governance. And although Beijing has been criticized for having enlisted United Nations officials and agencies to promote the BRI, it is clear that the promise of large doses of capital and Chinese expertise in terms of building roads and railways and airports and seaports and energy pipelines has considerable appeal to not just low and middle income countries, but also many high income countries. As the influential economist Branko Milanović has argued, affluent nations of the world have until recently basically withdrawn from the hard aspects of development and focused their development aid in recent decades on so-called soft areas, such as direct budget support to governments or funding initiatives that focus on good governance and transparency and empowerment of marginalized communities. Others also point to the fact that the BRI has actually fast-tracked the creation of new multilateral financial institutions that can usefully supplement the work of traditional multilateral financial institutions, so there's more money available for infrastructure investment. So they point to the creation of the New Development Bank, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and the Silk Road Fund, all with large doses of Chinese capital. A third set of issues relates to China's development diplomacy. Much of the new assertiveness in foreign policy and in pushing for the Belt and Road Initiative is derived from the soft power that Beijing has cultivated through its active aid and investments in large parts of the world over the past few decades. So China really does wield considerable influence in many low-income countries by virtue of its investments and foreign aid, which largely consists of grants, which is just free money, but largely concessional loans. So for instance, many countries in Africa have received large shares of Chinese aid and investments over the past two decades. But it is not just countries in Africa. Even countries in Southeast Asia, the former Soviet Union, and Latin America have received large numbers of infrastructure projects. And some of these have been termed as mega projects, as in having a financial value exceeding $1 billion. So what then is China's version of development diplomacy? Well, Chinese aid differs significantly from Western aid. Consider the fact that China, for example, does not abide by the so-called Paris Principles, which aim to achieve better impacts of aid by formulating aid policies around five pillars. These pillars include greater national ownership over aid recipients' self-identified development priorities, increased alignment between donor goals and recipient national priorities, the harmonization of aid from different donors to improve coordination, better management of aid to achieve measurable results, and greater accountability on the part of both donors and recipients for failed interventions. Unlike development assistance from most Western countries, Chinese aid does not come with stringent conditions for improving local governance, or for strengthening women's rights, or for combating corruption. And Beijing neither distinguishes between grants and loans it furnishes, nor offers detailed information about aid disbursements to individual countries. So one never really knows which country, which sector is receiving what. And in my own research, I've often had to rely on local media reports and even speeches by Chinese ambassadors or visiting officials to get a sort of an idea of what China is doing in a particular country. What is particularly interesting is that China's overall strategy is to present itself as a country driven by the conviction that state-to-state relations ought to benefit both parties. So when Beijing makes decisions about aid and investment projects around the world, it strives to present itself as not questioning the legitimacy of the governments in recipient countries. And China touts its aid policies as representative of a set of interrelated general principles, such as win-win outcomes or non-interference in the domestic affairs of other countries, mutual respect, friendship, and solidarity. So when it comes to development aid, development assistance, Chinese leaders are particularly wary of being perceived to be preaching to other countries. And Beijing routinely places a rhetorical emphasis on experience sharing between developing countries and economic self-reliance. And one way in which this is done is under the auspices of the so-called South-South Cooperation umbrella that Beijing has been a strong supporter of. Does this mean that everything is fine with Chinese development diplomacy? Well, despite the growing prominence and novel approach of Chinese foreign aid, it does suffer from challenges and limitations that often constrain its effectiveness and can distort its economic impact in many ways. One major concern that the citizens of some recipient countries have expressed is that certain projects may not be prudent or suitable for their particular circumstances. Some also criticize the one-size-fits-all model that China employs in large parts of the African continent, despite the continent's wide range of different sociopolitical conditions and cultural traditions. Another issue is the lack of transparency surrounding the terms of Chinese investment decisions and the size and nature of aid and investment allocations. China, therefore, has good reasons to try and improve on these aspects of its aid and investments portfolio and has recently set up an aid agency to coordinate such activities. The extent to which this agency will basically change things is uncertain, but China appears to be learning some of the lessons from its prior activities, at least on the African continent. The Chinese aid model has long been appealing to recipients due to its simplicity. The fact that there is no time-consuming planning phase, the lack of involvement of, say, expensive consultants, or the absence of critical civil society organizations that prevent, say, quick or pragmatic solutions. So the very fact that it is quick, it is simple, it does not have too many people making noises, asking difficult questions, has led to this kind of aid model being particularly appealing to countries which are desperate to just get things moving. Others, of course, have been critical, saying that such efforts have undermined Western efforts to promote good governance, to promote greater accountability, to combat corruption. But as the ambitious Belt and Road Initiative is steadily gaining momentum, Beijing is now aiming to leverage its long history of foreign aid to accrue more soft power as in trying to get others to be attracted to its model of development, to its culture, to its way of looking at the world. So by trying to accrue soft power, Beijing is gearing up for a more active role in global affairs. And according to recent surveys, say by Afrobarometer, the Chinese model of development, particularly in Africa, is getting more and more popular. And public perceptions of China's economic and political role and influence are perceived by many citizens to be both important and beneficial. And as a recent article in Foreign Affairs magazine put it, and I quote, "The global fallout of Trumpism has already pushed some countries toward China in ways that would have seemed inconceivable a few years ago," end quote. So what would China's role be then in a post-COVID world? I have tried to highlight three sets of factors that I believe will determine the extent to which Beijing will continue to exercise global influence in the near future, especially once we have moved on from the COVID crisis. The status of the United States as a global leader is currently under threat. Many traditional allies of the United States, including those in Europe or even Australia, are worried that the United States will not fight for them or stand up for them if a major crisis breaks out. And this type of feeling has been growing ever since 2016, following the election of President Trump. China, on the other hand, appears well-placed to reap the benefits of its development diplomacy, of the Belt and Road Initiative, and the growing global interest in sustainable development, in climate change, in addressing the adverse impacts of climate change. All of this is appealing to a growing number of countries around the world, not least also in the West. So the critical question is as follows. Who will risk discontinuing their already deep ties with and dependency on China? And I'm not just talking about low-income countries or aid recipient countries or countries with populist leaders. I'm also referring to high-income countries of Europe that are increasingly dependent on China, and these include Germany, where Angela Merkel's government has been quite reluctant to antagonize Beijing, which, again, some believe has undermined unity within the European Union. Another good case in point is how London has reaffirmed its commitment to allowing controversial Chinese tech giant Huawei to build parts of the UK's 5G network. And while some of the Nordic countries have first-hand experience of how it is to be banned from official contact with China, a very interesting recent case has been that of Australia, which has advocated an independent investigation into the origins and early handling of COVID. And this move by Australia has provoked a strong pushback from China, which has claimed that the call for such an investigation was a political maneuver against Beijing. There is, of course, now also much more awareness in Western capitals that one cannot just continue being so dependent on Beijing for everything. And some have been arguing that we should be producing face masks also in Western countries, in addition to importing face masks from China. But it is difficult to see how the benefits of global cooperation, of global trade, will suddenly cease in the future. This also means that while we may produce more things within our own borders, we will perhaps not stop relying on global supply chains. Then there's also the growing feeling among Western powers that while one cannot necessarily count on the support of the United States, one cannot necessarily count on Chinese support either. But all of this means that Beijing can't just continue to expect to increase its global influence. It must also be much more consistent in its policy priorities. For example, it is already facing considerable backlash in some African countries, such as Kenya, for promoting highly polluting coal-fired power plants and for cultivating close ties with ruling party officials. So Beijing will have to ensure that its massive infrastructure investments are not just environmental friendly, but that these also address local interests. And Beijing must also show patience and restraint to combat growing distrust in large parts of the world. How the United States-China relationship evolves and how protests in Hong Kong are handled will prove to be decisive in terms of which countries in the West are willing to abandon their traditional alliances and back China. Things could also change quite quickly following the presidential elections in the US later this year. So, for example, if Joe Biden is elected, perhaps the US-China relationship would improve. But even this is not a certainty, as there's growing anti-China sentiment among both Republicans and Democrats. Some African scholars have been arguing of late that the issue of debt relief will be the real test for China's commitment to the African continent, but also in other countries, in other parts of the world. And a recent report in the LA Times describes this concern that the global recession unleashed by COVID will pose a major test for the BRI as Beijing is facing pressure to cancel debts or at least reschedule them or renegotiate deals. The exact amount of debt owed to China is unclear, as transparency on such matters is lacking, something that I've discussed earlier. However, according to the LA Times report, it is believed that African nations alone owe China $145 billion, and $8 billion in payments is due this year. Even within China, some are worried that Beijing is being just too generous to foreign countries rather than eradicating poverty within its own borders. As Zhu Zhangrun, a prominent law professor from Tsinghua University in Beijing and a known critic of the Chinese regime, put it in 2018, and I quote, "Why is China, a country with over 100 million people who are still living below the poverty line, playing at being the flashy big spender? How can such wanton generosity be allowed?" End quote. With travel and trade taking a major hit, it will be crucial in the coming months to see how Beijing goes about continuing with BRI projects and addresses demands for debt relief. There's also growing animosity to Chinese businesses and migrants in some parts of the world, and this may increase in the near future, which in turn will make the Chinese less welcome than before in some parts of the world, in some countries. And this in turn could force China to rethink and or renegotiate its engagement in specific countries. Of crucial importance will be to watch whether Beijing is willing to explicitly project itself as an aspiring superpower and whether it will undertake harsh and punitive measures against those who criticize its policies. Any aggressive tactics by Beijing to coerce countries into supporting it could backfire. And then there's always the likelihood of change taking place within China, however unlikely it may appear at this stage. But when all is said and done, I believe China's global role and influence will continue to expand in the years to come. If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. I hope you will join me in the next episode when I discuss the characteristics of good and successful leaders and how leaders can and should respond effectively during a crisis.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo's Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.